I think the guy's a good director. I just think the story was bad.
So it's a James Wan type scenario.
Very much. And I saw Insidious 2, speaking of James
Wan. That's on Netflix now.
Yeah.
So I was tempted to check it out sometime.
My sister, who feels the same way about Insidious that you do, pretty much the exact same way, actually liked the second one. I think I kind of zoned out about halfway through the movie. I don't think I liked it as much.
Because we
both liked the beginning of Insidious.
Everything up until the other.
Right,
the ether, whatever they called it.
And they don't spend an awful lot of time in that realm in the second one. I mean, obviously, they have to do it.
But you're just killing me with the, like, is Patrick Wilson just living a normal life? Like, that's my concern. Like, that needs to be addressed in the first, like, 5 minutes.
It's addressed.
And it's going to lose me if it's not one
way. Like, it's fine. Like,
and they do take care of it okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they tell it, like, it's a good, I mean, that part of it's a good sequel. But the beginning, where the beginning of Insidious we thought was strong with some of the, like, the jump scares and the matched action stuff, it wasn't quite to that level in Insidious 2. So by the time they got and did the stuff that, you know, neither of us really like, I didn't think it was as strong to that point. So
I'd like to.
Better than Oculus, I think. What's up? This is Movies On Up. Ask not why you were in prison, ask why you were set free. I believe that's a direct quote from either my co-host, Mr. Dave Bacella, or John F. Kennedy.
I think it's just in loving memory of
ask
Reuben Hurricane
why
Carter.
You were imprisoned, ask why you were set free. That's my JFK impersonation. It's not great, but...
I didn't do it. That's my Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Fair enough. That's our impressions. That is also our tagline for this week. If you think you know what movie that comes from, ask not why you were imprisoned, ask why you were set free. We would ask that you send your guest to us in any of the following ways. moviesonup@gmail.com is the email address, @moviesonup on the Twitter, or facebook.com/moviesonup. If you are correct, if we choose you, then we will set free a prize package to your residence. It'll show up in probably a brown...
It'll show up by 2015.
It will show up by 2015. Probably. I mean, that is next year.
Asterisk. Potentially.
Yes, if not later than 2015. But you'll never know if you don't play. If you don't play, you can't win. And if you don't win, then we don't have
to. You lose 100% of the games you don't play.
Right. That's either Reuben Hurricane Carter or Wayne Gretzky. Paraphrased. At any rate, usually I have a good idea of why we do the topics we do. I think I might have an idea, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm going to let Dave explain why, for this week, we are going to be giving our top five...
foreign movies with American remakes.
Yes. Or perhaps vice versa, favorite American movies that were I don't know.
I did favorite foreign movies that were that have American remakes, and not necessarily supporting the American remakes in all the scenarios. Because Brick Mansions is coming out this week. Paul Walker, R.I.P., Paul Walker, David Bell, and the American remake of a French film that may pop up on one of our lists.
It's not mine.
It's mine. It's my number five, but we'll get to that. But just so we had no ideas. So I thought, I'm interested in that movie.
Interestingly enough, this is a list that if we, you know, would have waited about 3 weeks to do, I guess that would be okay as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that'll come up too.
I'm sure it will, and it'll come up in a couple weeks as well. I don't really know how I did my list. All of the movies on here are American movies that have all been remade from foreign movies. Now that in a lot of cases, I haven't seen the foreign version, but I've seen the American version and I like it. Some of them I've seen both, but that's a rarity.
See, mine are all foreign movies that have American remakes and that I like the foreign movie enough. So I guess we have two different lists this time.
I guess we both follow the rules. I mean, these are all movies that have American remakes.
And, you know, I tend to, any list we do, I always try to work the foreign stuff in. You know me.
Absolutely. So I tell you what, Dave, why don't you work in your first foreign flick with an American remake that you may or may not like?
My number five comes from France from 2004.
Is it Coneheads?
titled District B-13, starring David Bell.
That doesn't sound very French.
And Cyril Raffaelli. I think it's France, isn't it?
District B-13.
Well, the original name is Bonnaloo 13.
There you go.
Brick Mansions coming out this week is a remake of District B-13, and it's I think it's using the same script. Luc Besson's credited with writing both of them with Bibi Nasseri. So Luc Besson had a hand in both of them. Different director, Pierre Morel, directed District B-13. It's a really cool movie. Brick Mansions, kind of, the trailer set it up kind of well to where it's just this ghetto that nobody wants to go into. It's kind of been sanctioned off.
A la The Raid, maybe?
Kind of, yes. Yeah. So it's kind of its own neighborhood that is just almost kind of lawless. So they send an undercover cop with an ex-con who grew up there in to infiltrate it. That ex-con is David Bell, who is very awesome at parkour. I came across this movie because of there's the main scene that if you just go on YouTube and look up District B-13, there's about a 4-minute scene that's just David Bell parkouring the hell out of things, and it's awesome. The trailer for Brick Mansions kicks off with the beginning of that scene, and that made me want to check it out. And it spawned a couple sequels. The originals did. I'm excited to see how it does in America. I think it's going to be.
It'll get a bump at the very least because of Paul Walker.
Yeah, and I'm curious.
Cynical to say, but
where it could go if under different circumstances. Like, there was a lot of talk that Paul Walker's career was headed in a different direction due to the Hours, his performance in the Hours. He was getting a lot of different kind of jobs after that, and he hasn't had a lot of box office success outside of Fast and the Furious. But this movie actually looks pretty cool. And maybe it's because I like the original so much, but and I like parkour. And by the end of the week, there may be a blog post on moviesonup.com about my 5 favorite movies featuring parkour in them. District B-13 is really cool. Parkour aside, it's a cool story. It's a really good, gritty crime drama. And I really hope Brick Mansions carries that over because it's an awesome movie. It's a very cool idea. It's a very cool movie that could do well here. If executed correctly, could be an awesome American remake. And I kind of hope it does. I've never been excited about a Paul Walker movie before, and this is kind of a weird movie to be excited for, but I actually am. I really do want to see this, and a lot of it is because David Bell is in it, not really reprising his role, but playing the same role, because he was so key in those movies, and he made the District B-13 movies.
So obviously you haven't seen the American remake because it's not out yet. So fair enough. That was your number 5. My number 5. I've not seen the foreign remake. It is a movie from Iceland from 2001. It's called Either Way, directed by Hafstein Gunnar Sigurdsson. You may have seen it last year. It was directed by David Gordon Green's Prince Avalanche, starring Paul Rudd, Emil Hirsch. This movie makes my list based purely off of my Rudd love and my desire for this movie to be awesome. You've got Paul Rudd in an offbeat comedy. All right, so far, we're on to something. You have who I think is a pretty competent actor in Emil Hirsch, able to play off Paul Rudd's straight man character. Okay, I think we're on to something there as well. You add into that a couple of just beneath the surface relationship angles that don't really flesh themselves out until the very end of the second act or even into the third. And you have, I think on paper, what is a recipe for a really, really good movie. It never quite reached the expectations that I had, and it kind of feels like, at least to me, that the whole movie was really building towards something that it never quite reached. It's not the first time that you've seen Paul Rudd play kind of a dick character, but I think this is by far his flattest, maybe lowest key kind of jerk. It didn't have the laughs that I expected necessarily from a recent David Gordon Green movie, the guy that did Pineapple Express and what turns out to be Dave's favorite sword and sandal movie. But I think if you're a Paul Rudd fan, or even really an Emil Hirsch fan, because I think they both turn in pretty good performances. They essentially are the entire film. But I think that they both did well. Or, you know, if you're trying to get hyped for Joe that'll be out here this summer, take a look at David Gordon Green's effort from last year, Prince Avalanche.
I've said many, many times that I love David Gordon Green. I was big on David Gordon Green in that first part of his career with All the Real Girls, George Washington, and those really, really intense character dramas.
Before he made stoner comedy.
Before he got Pineapple Express, The Sitter, Your Highness, that really put his career in a different spot. This was cool because it's the perfect in between. Because his career's been on two ends of the spectrum. This is as close to the middle as you can be with that character-driven drama and that stoner comedy, because it's a very character-driven comedy. Joe is more leaning towards his early work, which I'm excited to see, because he took Paul Rudd, one of the most charming, likable, naturally funny guys, and made him not charming, not naturally funny, just almost unlikable. You do feel like it's building up to something, but I like that it really doesn't, because that's kind of their lives this whole time. You would think they thought their lives are building up to something, and it's not.
They're a road crew, essentially. Yeah. They're painting the road.
Yeah, so it's really, really, it's a unique movie. It's not driven by the ha-ha, split-my-pants laughs that you would expect from Paul Rudd and what David Gordon Green had been doing previously. But it's just really good, and I like seeing him do character stuff. And Emile Hirsch had a good year with this and Lone Survivor. You don't see a lot of like character-driven comedies anymore that are just driven by the scenarios they get themselves into. And it felt very real, which it didn't rely on like goofy stuff for the laughs. It felt very, very real. And Emile Hirsch felt like your cousin's loser boyfriend that everybody's met somebody like Emile Hirsch, which I thought it was a really interesting movie. For my number four, it's a Spanish movie from 2007 called Rec, remade a few years later as Quarantine for the States. Very, very cool zombie movie. I'm not breaking any news there. It's very popular among horror fans and among zombie fans. It's a zombie movie, as much as you want to call it a zombie movie. It's an infection movie.
It's a found footage zombie movie, which you hate found footage.
I do hate found footage.
It's good for you to like it.
Yeah, and it was done well, because my biggest problem with found footage is if you're stretching to make it found footage.
They were not. It was written well into the story.
It was very well into the story. She's a reporter. He's a cameraman. They're in this situation. That's what they do.
A story on the fire department, which just happens to get quarantined in a building infested with zombie-ish
The later wrecks are all very competent zombie movies, but just different.
It becomes formulaic.
It's very formulaic, and it lost what was original about it, because there weren't really any found footage zombie movies when Wreck hit the scene, and it was done well enough. It was a good zombie. It was a good scare. It was a good horror movie. It was a good. She was a good. I like Jennifer Carpenter enough, but I really thought Quarantine would have been a lot better with a different lead actress, because she was almost too annoying to like, and I would have rathered her died early on and leave without wasting an hour and a half. But as close as Quarantine was to Rec, I still think Rec is a far superior movie that did launch a franchise, which is it's a franchise in name only, because none of them really have that magic that the first one have, and they're just run-of-the-mill zombie movies pretty much. But the first one I thought was something really unique and really cool and really awesome with a not-so-awesome remake.
I would agree. I mean, I like both movies, but I do like Rec much better. But it does not make my list, primarily because I thought it might be on yours. My number four, I talked about my number five being sort of an offbeat comedy, not having quite the laughs that you would expect. My number four definitely has some laughs. It is a remake of a 1976 French movie called Les Jouets, directed by Francis Verber. It's the 1982 Richard Donner flick, The Toy, starring Richard Pryor, Jackie Gleason, and Scott Schwartz. You have two great, and I underline great, comedic actors in this one. Yeah, possibly the funniest guy from the 1950s in Jackie Gleason, and for my money, the funniest guy from the 80s in Richard Pryor. And I think as funny as Pryor's stand-up is, I think that his genius is in performance. If you go back and you watch Live on the Sunset Strip, which I do multiple times a year because it is brilliant, as great as his bits are, if you just read them on a page, it wouldn't quite be the same. I think you have to hear, Pryor and see his animation as he's talking about having lit himself on fire. His physical presence is, I kind of feel like, way, way, way underrated, but it's on absolute full display here. This is very much a physical comedy movie, and he absolutely nails it. He's pretty much your modern-day court jester that was purchased by Gleason for his brat son, and there's a little bit of a heart behind it as the two become friends, and Pryor kind of teaches this brat what it's like to actually have a real friend. Apparently, the kid didn't really take the lesson to heart. About 15 years later, he ended up doing porn. I feel like that's kind of more recently what people take away from this movie, but there's not a lot of a tremendous amount of Richard Pryor's work that you could show to an 8-9-year-old, but this absolutely you could, and I think it's one of the movies that you could enjoy with, you know, someone that is of that age, because Pryor's so good, he can entertain the 8-year-olds and, you know, the 48-year-olds at the same time. And it's a bummer that we didn't get to see more from Richard Pryor. I mean, he had a great film career. It could have been and should have been, I feel like, so much more than it was.
It's hard to look back on this movie and overlook the glaring, blatant racism in it.
But I think that's part of it.
It is a big part of it. It is. But one thing of that is it saved it from being remade. Like, you can't go and remake the toy in today's PC world without just people throwing a fit about it. But
I think you could, but you would have to have...
It would star Russell Brand.
if you did that, it would be, you know, the PC people wouldn't mind. But I think if you had the right... If you did it with Chris Rock, I think you could get away with it.
Yeah, but I mean, you're dead on about Pryor, because if you think of stand-ups that you don't even have to hear, but that you can watch their bit, that you can watch their sets on mute, Pryor and Eddie Murphy are two of the best ever, and then Chris Rock, who was heavily inspired by both of them, very animated, very good, and Pryor carried that into his movies, much like Eddie Murphy did. Chris Rock's never been able to have that success to film, but... Eddie Murphy and Pryor both carried that animation onto their performances on screen, and it carried over very well. And the toy is it's The Jerk. I mean, as far as what The Jerk is to Steve Martin as a performer, that's what the toy is. He did have a fantastic run in the 80s. Most of those Gene Wilder, Richard Pryor movies are special. Like, there's something about the two of them together. I mean, this is two geniuses, like comedic geniuses at the top of their game, working, not trying to show off, not trying to outshine each other, like just working off of each other, and it's brilliant. And it show, I mean, the toy is a perfect example that, as brilliant as they were together, Pryor had that on his own, and just like Frankenstein, like Wilder, those are two classic comedy performances, and then you team those two up, and it was, I love Pryor. I mean, his movie career was awesome, and I agree that I wish we had more. My number three comes from a little New Zealand movie recently remade this year, Starbuck from 2011, starring Patrick Heward as a guy who...
Is it from New Zealand?
It's French-Canadian. Its release is weird. It's...
Okay, I was going to say, like...
It's a French-Canadian movie originally released in New Zealand.
Fair enough.
So it was a hard sell at the time, but it's a very, very great
good
movie. Very good movie. Patrick Heward is absolutely perfect about... it was Delivery Man this past holiday season, starring Vince Vaughn, where a guy in his 40s, early 40s, you know, when he was younger, donated a lot to a sperm bank and ended up fathering a lot of children. And as his life's kind of not gone anywhere since, his lovers, you know, recently announced that she's pregnant. Now he's got a class action lawsuit from a lot of people wanting their biological father to step forward. And it's got a lot of heart, and it's really, really funny. And Patrick, I mean, Heward is such a good, charming, like, lead. Like, he's so good in this movie. And he's so likable, and it's got so much heart because of him. I haven't seen Delivery Man yet.
I was going to ask. I'm in the same boat.
I mean, I think it just came out on DVD a week or two ago. But we talked a lot about it coming up when it was released is we hope it was a Vince Vaughn comedy with heart and not just a Vince Vaughn comedy. Listener Tyler emailed me a while ago to tell me that he saw it and it did have a lot of heart, which is good to hear because without it, it doesn't. I mean, it's basically this guy trying to do something with his life and kind of almost becoming a guardian angel to the
becoming a guardian angel, trying to learn how to be a father for the kid he's actually going to have.
Yeah, through all these teenagers and older kids, he tries to make a difference in their lives after not being there for the first 17 to 20 years. But it's just a really good movie, and it's the kind of movie that does take – I mean, if Vince Vaughn made this movie right after Wedding Crashers when Vince Vaughn was – before people were almost tired of Vince Vaughn, I think it would have been an instant classic as an American movie because it's such a good story, and it requires that charismatic lead, which Vaughn is, but without the connotation he has now. But it's such a good movie, and if you haven't seen Starbuck, watch it. It's so good, and it's just so charming and funny that it's just a really, really good movie with a lot of heart.
I agree. Actually, I saw it not too long ago based on how highly you talk about it, and the heart is kind of the thing that I took away from it. I expected it to be funny, and it was. But that was after having seen it, my immediate reaction was, gosh, I hope when they do the American remake that it doesn't miss out on that, because it is a touching story, and it maybe on the surface it shouldn't be, or you wouldn't think that it is, but it is. So, you know, obviously
it's a premise that can be a dumb standard comedy, but it's a premise that flies high with the heart that required to do it. So
sure. So a lot of sex in your number three, in a manner of speaking. There's a fair amount of sex in my number three. We're sticking in France for a 2004 movie called Nathalie, directed by Anne Fontaine. It was remade in 2009 by Adam Eogan as Chloe, starring Julianne Moore, Amanda Seyfried, and Liam Neeson. Proof, if ever that you needed some, that hiring a prostitute to determine if your husband is a cheater is a horrible idea, especially if said prostitute looks like Amanda Seyfried. As a whole, this movie is not tremendous, but Julianne Moore is. She plays the suspicious wife of Liam Neeson, and as her suspicions grow throughout the movie, she begins to act more irrationally, and the movie's tone kind of reflects the emotional imbalance of her character, and I think that's really kind of a tough thing to pull off, but done really well in this movie. Things kind of spiral until you reach what is seemingly this inevitable point of how the hell did we, as you know, characters, as an audience, end up in this particular moment? And I think the French specifically really have a knack for this kind of movie. This, I don't know if you want to call it like a sexy time thriller, but maybe it sort of is. And I think that Eugen is a director that had done similar things before in his career. Exotica is a movie that comes to mind. So he was kind of the perfect guy to sort of adapt this for America. I think there's that kind of element of jealousy in both of those movies as well, Chloe and Exotica. I don't expect as much sexy time from his West Memphis 3 flick, The Devil's Knot, which is going to come out here in May. But again, it kind of shows the, not that there's just two sides of this particular director, but he can make those sexy time thrillers, and then he makes, you know, pretty serious movies.
I believe
as well.
The tagline for this movie was sexier than The Sweet Hereafter.
You know what? If it wasn't the tagline, that's just a fact, because it is, in fact, sexier than The Sweet Hereafter.
The saddest movie ever. This is a really good choice. It didn't even show up on my radar. I feel like this movie was almost a decade too late, because it was really, really good. But
I think we'd have gotten trouble if Amanda Seyfried would have been in this movie 10 years ago.
My point is, like, in the mid to late 90s, like,
somebody would have been in jail.
After Basic Instinct, you had this run of, like, Diabolique, Slither, Wrong Turn, like, all these. I know I'm missing a bunch. There was this run of just mainstream, sexy time thrillers released, and this one is better than all of those. And it's so weird because Julianne Moore seems to be less of a star now than she was late 90s, early 2000s. But in the last, like, 10 years, she's doing probably her best work. Like, everything Julianne Moore has been in, in the last decade or so.
She's awesome in Don John.
I haven't seen it yet.
She was awesome in it. Just trust me.
But like everything she's done, Children Men, even though it was a bit part good, Blindness, like Carrie, everything she's been in, she's just like dominated. And this is no exception. I mean, she was really, really good. And then you have Liam Neeson, who I thought was exceptional in this movie too, but he wasn't kicking people in the face, so it seemed like nobody really cared because that's where his career is at
where
right
we
now.
Want, we, you know, he's a man with a very specific set of skills now, and yeah. That's all we want
to
see.
And this is Amanda Seyfried's. Her career has been weird to me because she was at a peak with Mamma Mia, and that kind of launched her.
The musicals. I mean, Les Mis, she was really good in.
But like as a star, you know, she had Red Riding Hood, which was her starring vehicle that was a disaster and it bombed.
Jennifer's Body really kind of bombed
and
as well.
And it just seems like her as, which is probably good because her is in those main, both those movies are pretty terrible. So she's gone and done Lovely. She did Chloe. Like, she's really good and far more talented than her mainstream movies would give her credit for. And Chloe's a perfect example of that because she goes toe-to-toe with Julianne Moore and she's right there with her.
It's a much different performance than Julianne Moore's. But, yeah, she does. Everybody in the movie is really good, but to me, Julianne Moore really did stick out because you can see that character like starts out kind of frayed and then it just gets worse. She gets more and more frazzled and you kind of get to see maybe a different side, no pun intended, of Seyfried, where she kind of is a little bit manipulative. It's a neat flick. It's not maybe my favorite movie, but in terms of remakes, I haven't seen the French movie, but having seen enough of those movies, I did think this was very fitting in that genre.
I think Julianne Moore right now is at a peak where she's probably one of the hardest actresses to be on screen with because she's just so into everything and so committed to, she's just at the top of her game right now. My number two, speaking of another actress that just is into it and just dominates on screen, a little Swiss film from 2009 that introduced us to Noomi Rapace, the girl with the dragon tattoo, based on the Stieg Larsson first book in his series.
The girl with the dragon tattoo.
Yeah. My goodness. It's such a dark story, such a dark movie, and it's such a dark book. And she brought the character to life perfectly. She's tortured. She's crushed. Like, there's a reason she's a big-time movie star in the States now. You have tons of actors and actresses have great success overseas, and then that doesn't translate over here. But she's crossed over and starring in these great movies alongside great actors because of these movies. He's introduced, and that's the biggest thing you take away from these movies, all three of the original trilogy. They're okay movies, but they're absolutely phenomenal movies to watch just because of her, really. Her acting performance on screen is ridiculous. And the American remake, say what you will about it, there's a reason they haven't sped into the next two of them when these are so popular and the book series is so popular. The American felt like they were trying to capture the magic that this just did naturally, and they were trying too hard to carry that disturbing darkness when this just had a natural feel to it. And nothing against Rooney Mara, but my goodness, Noomi Rapace owned this role. Rooney Mara, she was fine. She did well and good. She was on par with the quality of that movie, but Noomi Rapace is something. And you watch this and if you'd never seen a movie before, you would think, oh, that's got to be one of the biggest, like, big-time actresses in the world. And she will be.
She's getting there.
She's getting there. And she's so phenomenal in this movie. And it's worth the movie itself. Like, it's worth reading the books just to see how well she brings that character to life. Because they are a hard series to read. And it's kind of hard to picture. And it's a good enough adaptation of the book. They do well enough. It was a better adaptation than the American version, but just very, very, very good. And like I said, there's a reason the original was a trilogy, and we're still waiting on number two here.
I've actually only seen the American remakes. I've read the book, so I'm familiar with the story. But you're right. I was kind of less than impressed Nothing against James Bond or Rooney Mara. They're fine. But eventually I will have to sit through the Swedish movies just to check out Noomi Rapace, because she is usually very good in whatever she's in, even if it does happen to be garbage. My number two, this is where I feel like I'm getting a little bit predictable if you've really ever listened to me on this podcast. And there's a definite relationship between my number two and my number one. My number two is a remake of a Japanese movie from 1954, directed by Akira Kurosawa. His Seven Samurai was remade into 1960's The Magnificent Seven, directed by John Sturges, starring Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Charlie Bronson. Kurosawa gets a lot of credit for being an amazing filmmaker, and he is. He's also very deliberate in his pacing, and the shots he chooses are chosen for a reason. They tend to be very symbolic, which are, I feel like they're both traits of great Asian directors, and maybe that's where they get it from maybe the OG of great Asian directors. However, those things, deliberate pacing and symbolism, not necessarily things that Americans tend to value en masse as a movie audience. So the question becomes, how do you get American audiences on board with this kind of 300-esque story, long before 300 was a thing, about a band of mostly heroic mercenary Ronin? The answer is, you sub out the swords for shotguns and you make a Western out of it. The exact same story arc is followed in each movie. Sturges just switches out the samurai for cowboys and the raiding Asian bandits for Mexican banditos. The battle scenes become gunfights and you don't have to read subtitles. So that seemingly solves all your problems right there. Both movies are really good. I do like Seven Samurai better. The next two movies are the only movies on my list where I've actually seen both, and it's because the American remake is good and the foreign one is pretty good too. I do just happen to prefer Seven Samurai. I will concede, though, that it is a bit art house, to say the least, and at damn near 3.5 hours, it's tough to get through. Sturges kind of gives you the cliff notes at around 2 hours and adds some gunplay to liven things up. So I would say, unless you're a big fan of 1950s Asian cinema, maybe just watch Magnificent Seven. You'll get out of it an hour and a half earlier, and you'll have a good idea of what the story's like. If you become a giant fan of that movie, all right, check out The Seven Samurai, because you won't be disappointed. You just might be bored for about, I don't know, an hour and 45 minutes. I think that's fair, but that's my number two.
My number one, a little different than the rest of my list. I've either not seen the American remake or not liked the American remake. Until my number one I thought was a very, very, very good American remake, albeit unnecessary because it was shot for shot. We're going back to Sweden for 2008's Let the Right One In. I've talked plenty on this show before about Let the Right One In and Let Me In being some of the best all-time love stories, children-led movies, vampire
children
movies.
Children love stories.
Yes, children romance story. Like, I mean, everything was really, really good, and Let the Right One In did cross over very well. And occasionally you get those foreign films that are foreign language films that kind of break into the mainstream and become very popular, like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Let the Right One In. When it came out, a lot, it was a very, very popular movie over here, directed by Thomas Alfredson, written by J.A. Lundquist, based on the novel by J.A. Lundquist. And there's a lot to be said when a novelist can adapt their own work into a screenplay, because, yeah, the movie is a little different. There is some stuff lost in translation, but it works. And it's, when you're judging by who is losing that in translation, it's a little easier when it's somebody that has a right to say what can afford to not be translated over and what is. And it's a fantastic screenplay. It's a slow burn. I mean, it's not your...
When you say a vampire movie, it's not...
It's not The Lost Boys.
Yeah.
It's not... It's definitely not The Lost Boys. It's a slow burn as far as vampire movies are going. Much like we talked about Prince Avalanche being a character movie, this is 100% you're following the two leads, which in the original was Kerr Hedebrandt and Lena Leanderson. as Oscar and Eli, where American Cody Smith McPhee and Chloe Grace Moretz, which both amazing actors, and they nailed it. And then Richard Jenkins as the kind of third wheel there. But fantastic movie, and it says a lot for a Swedish film to kind of break into the American mainstream. And that's kind of why Let Me In was such a disaster financially, because it followed so soon. I mean, it just came
so soon, and it's so much a shot for shot remake.
It's exactly the same movie, just in English. And it makes sense to make an American when you have this foreign gem that doesn't cross into American mainstream, to make the American remake shot for shot. Like, if Let the Right One In kind of got swept under the rug and didn't really infiltrate our mainstream, Let Me In is 1,000 times more of a better movie, because it's probably seen by more people. But when that Swedish film does infiltrate pop culture and the remake comes out when it's still in people's minds, I don't understand how you can expect to be successful, because the common thought is, I'll just go see this movie that everybody else has said is great. And it's not like it's a dialogue-heavy movie, so you're not reading a lot, because it's a very moody, slowly paced movie.
It did seem weird to remake that movie when they did. Really, there was starting to be a buzz for Let the Right One In as probably the best vampire movie of all time. And I think it was available streaming on Netflix before the American hit the theater. So again, a lot of people were like, okay, I can wait a month, 2 months, whatever it was, and pay $10 a head to go see this in the theater, or I can just see what everybody's saying is an awesome movie right now, knowing that they're at the very least going to be very similar. Now, they turned out to be the exact same thing. So you either have to pick a movie that is absolutely overlooked in America, which, you know, I guess Let the Right One In was sort of, but not to that nobody's ever heard of this before, or you have to wait so long to where you have maybe a new crop of people that don't know about it, or wait for some of that buzz that it was getting on its own to die down. I've never seen the American remake, and I don't feel like I need to.
No, and it's really good. Maybe the girl with the dragon tattoo suffered from the same fate, because people were familiar with the Noomi Rapace version. People were familiar with it. Maybe they didn't need to see it again, because if you like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you're used to reading, so it doesn't matter what language it's in, because chances are you've read the story already. But Let the Right One In is such, I mean, it's a classic. It's absolutely, yeah, it's only, you know, 5 years old by now, but 6 years old, but it's absolute classic. And I have no problem saying that in, you know, 20 years, this will be one of those classic pieces of cinema that people look back on, because it is such a piece of art. It's everything a movie should be, and that's why it was my number one.
My number one is a classic as well. It is a remake of a 1961 Japanese film, Yojimbo, directed again by Akira Kurosawa. This one is 1964's Fistful of Dollars, directed by Sergio Leone, starring Clint Eastwood, Maria Volante, and Marianne Koch. I allowed myself a little bit more latitude in my definition of a remake, especially for these last two. It's possible that I could have made a list based entirely on Kurosawa movies if I'd have given myself, I guess, some more leash. I talk about the remake of Seven Samurai, remake of Yojimbo. They did a Western version of Rashomon too, and George Lucas borrowed pretty heavily off a Kurosawa movie for one of his movies. I'm not real sure which one it was. But there's a reason why Kurosawa stuff gets remade. Again, this is pretty much just a Western version of a samurai tale, wherein this time our hero plays two rival scumbags against each other in hopes of getting rid of both. Yojimbo itself is an adaptation of a Dashiell Hammett novel called Red Harvest. Leone actually was sued by Kurosawa and his fellow screenwriter, who I'm not even trying to pronounce that dude's name, for breach of copyright. They actually won the lawsuit and got 15% of Fistful of Dollars' worldwide gross, and Kurosawa went on to say that he made more money off that lawsuit than he did off Yojimbo to begin with. A lot of people kind of point to this movie as the OG of the spaghetti westerns. It really wasn't the first. It just happened to be the first that really got a wide international release. It is my favorite of the Man with No Name trilogy. It's really where you get that distinct Eastwood style, the squinting, the cigars, the whole nine yards there. And we almost didn't even get to see that as I believe it was Henry Fonda, Charlie Bronson, Richard Harrison, Eric Fleming all passed on the role before it finally became available to Clint Eastwood. And I don't know if I have to turn in some kind of cinephile card for this, but I actually prefer Fistful of Dollars to Yojimbo. Coming at me, Criterion Police, whatever. I do really, really like the American version. It's not even an American version. It's a spaghetti western. So it was an Italian movie, but English, I guess. It was dubbed in, you know, English. I don't know. Again, maybe I used a little bit more leash on my number one, but it's a remake of a foreign movie that's now in English. So I'm counting it.
Did you have any also-rans?
I had a lot of also-rans. Things that I... The Departed.
See, I have three, like, obvious ones. The Departed, Don't Yell at Us, because we generally do leave obvious ones
off. I just
off.
Used The Departed in a list not too long ago.
Yeah,
so.
And Old Boy.
Yeah.
I love Old Boy. I haven't seen the Spike Lee joint yet. Godzilla, I think, is another very... Any of those three could have been in my top five, I think. And then one that I've had on a lot of lists lately that I left off is Death at a Funeral. Absolutely love that movie. I like the American version too, but all four of those movies could have easily been in my top five. And yeah, maybe they're obvious ones, but I think Girl with Dragon Tattoo and Let the Right One In too are. But I feel more strongly about those two than the other four, except maybe Death at a Funeral. But so those are the obvious ones I left off, but that's really all for my also-rans.
I had a few. There were some that, like you mentioned, Let the Right One In. I left it off because it was so much shot for shot. I like Funny Games. Michael Haneke remade his own movie just in English. Again, that's shot for shot.
And, yeah, I don't like either of them.
Fair enough. I like the movie, but I didn't put it on because if you're going to remake something shot for shot, I didn't feel there was a reason to put it on the list. I like The Grudge and The Ring. Those were both ones that kind of jumped out, especially maybe The Ring as being a little bit obvious. Insomnia just got cut off my list. And True Lies was a remake of a French jam. Both of those, True Lies and Insomnia, were kind of the last two that I cut. And the only reason I really cut them was because I thought that they might appear on your list. So I just got rid of them. But
yeah,
I like both.
And The Ring and The Grudge, like it's hard to do this list without mentioning those two because that kicked off. The Ring particularly kicked off this, oh, hey, let's adapt every Japanese horror movie ever. And The Grudge found some success shortly after, so that's why we had The Eye,
yeah.
Pulse, Dark Waters. There was a handful all right there, and One Missed Call, I believe, was just all, I can't remember.
They were either Japanese or I think some of those were Korean, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, there definitely was an influx of Asian horror movies that got remade, and most of them were bad, although I do like The Ring and The Grudge. Just for argument's sake, or at least for the sake of ease, I've been trying to remember to recap the top five, but a lot of times I forget. But I made a note this time. Dave, why don't you recap your five movies from five to one?
My number five, District B-13. Number four, Wreck. Number three, Starbuck. Number two, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And number one was Let the Right One In.
My number five was Prince Avalanche. Four, The Toy. Three, Chloe. Two, The Magnificent Seven. And number one, Fistful of Dollars. I feel like there was a lot that I left off. So I'm sure that we've probably left off something that you guys really, if you really want to tell me about how great The Departed was, I'd love to hear about it because I do genuinely like The Departed. And I think I may have misidentified that. Infernal Affairs was a Chinese film. I think I may have called it Korean when I put it on my list before. So if you want to rake me over the coals for that, go ahead. But we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, moviesonup@gmail.com. You can tweet your thoughts at us at moviesonup on the Twitter or leave us a Facebook post, facebook.com/moviesonup.
And get at us because we, coming up, not next week, the week after, is our 2-year anniversary show. Kind of hard to believe we've been doing this for 2 years and haven't taken a week off. So we're pretty proud of that. If you have any ideas or anything you like from the last 2 years that you think we should mention in our 2-year anniversary week, let us know. Next week's a cool week. I always like our season previews. We do one in the fall and we do the summer preview. Next week is the summer preview. We're going to bring Box Office Bash back. We'll have a blog post about that. We'll go over the rules next week. We're going to go month by month through the summer and then hold our box office draft and lay out the rules for you. Last year, I had a lot of fun with it. I think I kind of dominated it, if I remember correctly. A fun few weeks coming into Movies on Up, and especially with the summer. It's summer movie season, which I think now is way different than what summer has been in the past, and we will talk more about that. But we'll be back next week with our summer preview, which will be a lot of fun. So until then,
keep it up.